Welcome to Doctor's Orders with your host, Dr. Baker. Now let's join today's program.
Hello, everybody. This is Doctor's Orders. I am Dr. Baker, the owner of the only business hospital in the world, servicing five continents, 14 countries, and really excited that I'm here today to talk with you all. It's always my pleasure to help businesses do better, and so it is my works and my life's pleasure and my work to make sure that your businesses are increasing in its overall health metrics, making sure that your dream continues to grow and does not go in reverse. And if you've been listening to the show for any given time, you know that every day we have a different topic. And today on Trending Thursday, we're going to talk more again about just all things in the internet, all things small business based, and all things security, because I find it really important and very intriguing that as a small business owners, there's so many obstacles that come up that kind of bite you. You know, so many unknown variables that exist out there that prohibit you from really reaching the mountain of success that you might see in your mind. And technology is one of these realities that it can definitely pose a threat to us. It could slow us down, even though it's built to be wonderful for us. It can certainly slow us down. And if there's anyone out there listening today that wants to join the conversation, you can do so by calling in at 859-291-2255. That's 859-291-2255. And you can send a message directly at info@drbaker.us. Once again, that's info@drbaker.us. And so I'm bringing on today a guest that has been here before and has offered valuable insight in the world of cybersecurity. And I think that our dialogue really can't be enough. I think we need to learn more about what's going on in the digital space, in the digital world. Things are continuously changing, and those changes, and many times, are happening to us. We are not the conduit of change ourselves, but we're reacting to other players in the space that push these realities along to us, and we have to make declarations on how we're going to interact with it. And so the smarter we are from the onset, the better it is for us individually, the better it is for our businesses and overall health of our operation. And so without further ado, I'll bring in Iku Williams of CyberSure. And so Iku, thanks again for taking the time to be with us today. How you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Doing fantastic. You know, just having another day of helping businesses explore their journey. And you've been, you know, traveling some with your work, and you've done a lot of work here just in the Ohio region. Is there anything that you've seen here since we spoke last that's kind of come up a little bit in the cybersecurity space that we may need to wrap our minds around or have our antennas up on?
I think from a cybersecurity standpoint, really paying attention to password security. I know there's been a huge push in the industry about using multi-factor authentication, as well as really increasing the security around passwords. Cyber criminals now are really starting to figure out ways to get around multi-factor authentication, as well as, you know, picking and choosing and picking through passwords. So that's one of the bigger topics, as well as making sure that individuals are updating any type of updates, what I would consider patch management, on their devices. And so for patch management, to give an example, when usually on your computer, sometimes depending on the software, it'll always be those automatic updates that comes to your device from Office 365. That is the actual software developer trying to be proactive because they realize it's some vulnerabilities in the software or hardware that you are using. So it is advised that whenever these updates do come out that you complete those updates. You want to be proactive in trying to make your secure. If not, the bad actors or cyber criminals who are already ahead of the game. They know the vulnerabilities in the systems. They know the vulnerabilities in the software. So you want to get ahead of that and actually put what I would consider like a patch management program in place in your organization where it's automatically done. Sometimes you don't want to give even your users a choice. you just want to push it through. Because if you don't, let's be honest, as humans, if we're not familiar or not comfortable with it, if that's not your background in IT, you're hesitant to do that, or you'll just hit next or say, I'll do it later. But the longer you keep that window open for vulnerabilities, the sooner the cyber criminals can get in.
Well, you know, we're talking about vulnerability, password authentication, and what I notice nowadays is a lot of people are doing work from their phones. I'm not so much a proponent of it. I always talk against it, even though we're in such a convenient world and we have our phones so much that in our minds, our phones are now our computers. And so the iPhone takes the place of the personal computer or the Mac. Are scenarios or, I guess, tools such as biometrics, does that actually, you know, secure iPhones? Is that legitimate, or is there ways where the information is still at risk?
From a biometric standpoint, that goes to what I would call your multi-factor authentication. So you have your biometrics where, you know, look at your iPhone, where, you know, face recognition or using fingerprints. That's something that really can't be copied. It's good to have, you know, as well as when you get those text messages from the appliance or software or app for your device. So if you're trying to log in to, say, your email, you know, you put in your username and password, but then it'll ask you to authenticate, and then that's when you get that text message with usually, you know, a 4 to 8 digit number that you type in or confirm, that allows you to get in as well. But those are good. Those are good things to use. There's also password management tools out there now that are very good, where it essentially rotates passwords using all sorts of different uppercase, lowercase, as well as characters, all jumbled together, and which are also encrypted. So that is kind of a new, it's been around for
a while. Well, I don't know. I know a lot of people, they don't want to change their passwords regularly. They don't want to deal with that headache. They feel really irritated by it. But you're saying there's a tool that makes that part of your life easier. Now, does that tool also help you capture them? Because if you're like me, then I've got, you know, spreadsheets worth of passwords based on every tool or you know, filing that I need to get into. Is there tools that help make that more efficient or help organize that information so people really aren't trying to figure out what, you know, what my password is? Am I locked out if I do it 3 times incorrectly? You know, do those tools help with that type of behavior?
It does. It prevents the user from even worrying about a password. Are you doing it because of the tool set? You know, depending on what needs the passwords, you essentially use that tool, and that uniqueness is something you don't have to worry about. So you're never changing your password. That's something you don't worry about. You have a tool that's incorporated into the software or application that you're using, and it always will put a password in for you.
Okay.
So you're authenticated by the tool. So whatever, we'll just say now, which is also good, using single sign-on. So if you sign on to your device, and a lot of times it uses that same user ID and password across the board, then it is very good for that. Because, again, you don't have to worry about every 30, 60, 90 days where you're constantly getting a reminder, now it's time to change your password. It's very tiresome. And, you know, even as someone who's in cybersecurity with an audit background, I even get tired of it myself. But I have to do it because I don't have that tool.
Well, I think you understand the importance of it and what that means to your business in the event of a breach or some other security issue that may arise from there. And, you know, let's just look at the culture where we are, you know, as people in society. You know, there's some people that I know that their data and their technology is connected. So their business technology is connected to their personal, and then, you know, it's connected to their financial. Talk to us a little bit about those practices. Is it, you know, is the integration, even though it's efficient, is it healthy to do that? And is there ways to protect it, or is it better to segregate them and then have them isolated to where you're not affected by, you know, one issue or another?
Are you talking about segregating the data or just segregating
all your technology functions that's moving your data around. So you've got a scenario to where if I do a lot of work on my cell phone and I'm a very small micro or boutique business owner, or maybe I've got a few employees, but yet and still my phone is the lifeline, which is also the lifeline for my personal banking, which is also the lifeline for my security code to get into my house and everything else.
Oh, yeah, well, one, it's always good to kind of have different data points or from a standpoint of saving that data, right? So if, for example, you mentioned banking, unless you're keeping spreadsheets on your phone versus your laptop, look at that as a way of you're always having an additional backup, if that makes sense. Because if something was to get encrypted or breached, say your laptop, if you have that same information on your phone, then at least you have that information. I won't necessarily say it's secure, but you have it. And then you can bring that information back. A lot of people are using a lot of cloud services as well to store their data. So, again, that gives you another place to have your information, which is secure, because you're paying for a service. But, again, you're hoping to secure it. But at the same time, it's using – go ahead.
No, go ahead. I want to hear the rest of it. I'm sorry.
No, so not just having it in the cloud, but it's good to have your own kind of server or additional – we'll say for smaller shops, I always say use an external hard drive as your backup as well. So you always want to have information in different places that's secure, because you never know when you could lose something.
Well, I was going to talk about just even the cloud-based services. I met with a few patients yesterday, and, you know, to my surprise with these two, they really were not comfortable with all of cloud services. Even just the mention of Dropbox was, no, I don't really work with that. Have you seen a lot of skepticism in the space as it relates to cloud, or are more people embracing cloud and then understanding how to protect their information or their data even when they're using cloud-based services?
It's actually an upward tick more towards using the cloud, and that is because they feel like it's more secure having it away from their environment, if that makes sense. And it's also cheaper. So you don't have to do the maintenance. You don't have to actually own a server. A lot of people are saying, hey, I'd rather pay this monthly fee. You host the data. If I lose the data, it's on you. You know, there's things that can happen when it comes to that. But the skepticism really comes from more of your smaller shops that don't have a lot of data that feels like, is there even a need for that? But the reality is, if you watch the news or read, they're being attacked as well.
Well, you know, I think that's what scares people, is that when you look at large companies that have issues, you know, there's information in the news right now regarding, you know, things that Twitter has done or hasn't done. Everyone remembers, you know, what happened in Facebook. And if you're a person using social media, one, for your personal matters, but then two, to advertise or market for your business, does that draw concern with, well, I mean, heck, if these larger companies are having issues, then certainly I could have issues at a smaller level. Or is it more of the mentality that, well, I'm too small for this to even matter, nothing will ever hit me? What do you typically see out there?
You typically see that from the standpoint of, I want it out there, I want it secure. I'm going to take a step back. One of the things that I tell my clients is there is a report out there. It's called a SOC 2 report, and this is very important. This SOC 2 report is basically validating that your third-party vendor has had an audit completed, verifying that the adequate controls have been tested and provide you assurance that your data is secure. So what that means is they look at, where is the data at, how is it being secured, what are the policies and procedures around how they store, keep, and provide data, and testing those controls. So we'll just say that Amazon will have to have a third-party auditor come in, do an audit of your basically data security. They then provide that company with a report, Amazon with a report. That report is what gets sent to their customers. So that is proof that, and it gives you another level of comfort that you guys are doing everything pretty much possible to secure the data that I have. So if you are a business and you work with a cloud service, you should be able to simply call them up and say, can you provide me your SOC 2 report? If they do not have one, then I suggest that you leave that company as soon as possible. Now, if it's something that they say, well, it's on deck, we're about to have a SOC 2 report done in the next 30, 69 days or whatever, then that gives you level of comfort. But if they're not even willing to get one done because they feel like we don't need that, I would move away from them, because even though they're saying your data is secure, it hasn't been tested. The controls have not been tested adequately. Therefore, if they are breached, who's the brunt of that blame? And that's going to be you as a business owner. Because
I would make the argument that most micro boutique mom and pop shops, they would never know that a SOC 2 report would exist. But larger companies, I would say those that are bigger than a class 1, would know about that because their departments hopefully would have been trained or been versed on understanding that they should request that. Is that about the general rule that you've seen?
No, that's absolutely right. Your smaller ones do not know to ask that. They really aren't even familiar what a SOC 2 is. Like, I've been doing speaking engagements and with smaller entities, and their eyes open up when I say SOC 2. The first question is like, wait a minute, pause. What is it? Like, can I ask them now? Like, I'm literally saying, yeah, once I'm done here, go call them. It should be a yes or no answer. Mm-hmm. Like, if you are paying them to secure your data, you should be able to see if they have a SOC 2 report. And if they don't have one, that means they're not taking the extra steps to make sure they are protecting your data.
Well, you know, I want to make data really simple and really plain for the listeners. Because sometimes you can use a word like that and it just becomes ambiguous, doesn't have a real meaning to everyone. But if you're collecting email addresses, if you're collecting phone numbers, if you know, you're taking in private information or non-public information, such as a driver's license or any of that identification, especially a social security number, but all of that is data. Is that right?
That's correct. I look at data and put in simple terms. If you're using a third-party vendor to store any information, period, especially if it's client's information of yours, you want to make sure that information is secure.
And so as we talk about data, it always surprises me how much data that a company has that they never even considered that was the case. And so they've allowed themselves to be open in a lot of places, and especially with hybrid working, I won't necessarily call it remote anymore because so many people are going back to the office, that it's more hybrid, not all the way back to our original state, but people are doing both. When you're working in coffee shops or you're working at a bookstore, library, are public Wi-Fi safe, equal, or should they be avoided? And you should have some kind of tool to help protect you when you're in these public places.
I would, 9 times out of 10, your coffee shops are not on secure Wi-Fi. So if you just want to scroll the internet, like look at ESPN, look at very vague objects on the internet, you're fine. But you never want to, for example, sit on Amazon and order information. You don't want to do that. Any kind of information that gets passed through that will be considered like personal identifiable information, like your name, your address, paying bills where you have to type in your credit card information. I would never do that in a Wi-Fi because 9 times out of 10 it's not secure. So that's not a good place to do that type of work. Even the average person working, if you really pay attention, a lot of times they're using like their own secure device and it's next to them. But you should never use, what is the, that famous coffee spot that everybody goes to?
What, Starbucks?
Yeah, Starbucks. You're like, it's unsecure. But a lot of these same places, once you get on, they'll tell you that notification comes up saying, thank you for using my Wi-Fi, but it's unsecure. So they're giving you the options. because...
But even though people see that option, though, Iku, you have a reality that they still bypass it because they might be there for 4 hours. They're there for an hour and a half. And so you open one tab up, which might have just been a general search, but now you might actually be at a bill-paying site, or you might actually be inside of your company's back end. And because you're there for a reason, but now you've exposed yourself. And if you've done that, are there other protective measures to take, or is the only protective measure, sorry for the actual word choice, but it's really abstinence from that point. Get away from it and don't do it. Maybe use the hotspot from your cell phone.
Okay, correct. I would advise you to hotspot your hotspot from your cell phone, or if you have one from your work. Hopefully, even if you are working in VPNN, it's still a back channel that someone can follow you through that tunnel. And sometimes people don't think that. They're like, oh, I'm logging into work. I can put in my VPN. I'm good to go. But you still have to understand that you're still on their network going to yours. So that's just like walking through a revolving door and you're not paying attention to it, and someone is walking right behind you to get into the office or building. And that's exactly
a really good point. And I want to sit there for a moment, because if someone did get, use their VPN, and they might think that I'm really safe now. But what you're describing is that, it's a measure, but it still doesn't prevent you from still having the risk because of the reality of being on the network. What is it about what I would call just the confusion of the messaging when it comes to, well, as long as I'm on my VPN, I'm fine, or anything else that might just be circulating amongst the commoners as it relates to, am I safe when I'm out in public or not?
It's education, right? That's really the big thing. As an organization, you should be preaching to your staff about that, right? If you're going to work outside of work, and a lot of companies are actually doing this because, like we were talking about earlier, a lot of people are working from home, so they're going on about their life, stopping out to get coffee. I can sit here, have a meeting. So a lot of people are actually creating policies now that says do not do, specific work on an unsecure network. Both speaking of these coffee shops, because people are getting breached because you have cyber criminals that are actually sitting and waiting, and actually people, they're seeing the traffic on that URL or that Wi-Fi, and essentially they can see who's insecure, boom, and follow them in.
Does that go for the same for hotels and for those individuals that travel so much?
A lot of hotels, some hotels will have a secure website, URL for you to use, because they understand conferences are there, people are working there. So majority of the time, they are secure.
And so log in there and you feel secure there. So for that travel person, they could feel better about, I don't have to use all my data because I'm on a 6-day trip and I've got to, I'm in two different hotels while I'm on this trip. I don't have to use all my data if I don't have unlimited data, which I think most business people would or should, but they would be okay using the hotel's data or the hotel's Wi-Fi rather.
Correct.
Well, looking at, just these behaviors and our digital footprint, it continues to grow because our integration is now so dependent on technology that, our phones are opening up our house. It's mopping our floors. It's doing all the stuff. And, is it a scenario where is it more about the network, or is it more about just other vulnerabilities such as your password or even phishing techniques? How do people prepare themselves against phishing?
The best way to prepare yourself against phishing is one. I'm always say educate. But the best way to really prevent it, if you get these emails, is if it's a work email, am I usually getting this email? Does this email make sense? Is what this person asked me for my account number? I don't care if it's my boss, right? Because now they're getting smart enough. They're emulating the boss. They're actually making themselves look like the boss using the exact same signature. And they're actually emulating the same language that bots would use as they would communicate with you. You know, hover over, you know, if you look at where the email is coming from, you can hover over the email address and it'll actually spell out where that email is coming from. Is it truly coming from that organization? You know, it might say, the email might say Fifth Third Bank, but you hover over it and it might be something Istanbul.com. But understanding and being educated on that when it comes to phishing, don't just click on anything that you're unfamiliar with. Validate, you know, put that phone call in if you're at work. Hey, Bob, I just got the email from you. Is this something you really want to do? At that point, Bob would say, nope, that's not even me. That's a fake email. So you have those instances. I'll say Google, if you're using Gmail right now, they actually have a button located that you can report phishing emails to Google so they can start doing analytics and research on them to start eliminating that those type of emails that go to people who are using Gmail. Work with, if you are a business, you can add this, that feature for Office 365 as well, where you can essentially tag it and hit the button, and it'll actually remove that email from your inbox, or put email filtering on. You know, there's different things that we can do as users to kind of be proactive as well, but it's really on us to really pay attention to what we're clicking on, putting our information in places that we're unfamiliar with, a lot, everything from that standpoint.
You know, you mentioned Google. I know a lot of business owners that run their business off of the suite packaging of Google. And are there heightened concerns or are there diminished or lessened concerns considering that, you know, Google is the mammoth that it is and that they should have all the protective measures in place? Or should there be some level of concern and there should be some additional privacy or protection put in place if you're using Google to run your business?
No, it shouldn't be any additional concerns. No matter your platform, there's always going to be that risk and vulnerability there. But the reality is, it's not always the platform. It's the user. It's the individual who didn't pay attention to the email they received and clicked on that link or put in that information that they shouldn't have, that now exposes the department. Because a lot of, like, school systems, a lot of organizations use their platform. So it's very common for companies to use Google, but it's not the weakness within Google. It is the user who makes the mistake on their platform, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's the human. It's us.
Which goes back to your point of education and user education. Now, with that end-user education, I recognize that in a larger entity, let's say you're at a Fortune 500 company, well, they're going to go ahead and they're going to take responsibility for parts of that education, and some are better than others, but ultimately it's the company's position and responsibility to make sure that all the employees know how to behave and keep themselves safe from breaches, just having really good best practices. But when you're a smaller company and, you know, you're hanging with, you know, 10 or less employees, it may not be clear as to who should teach it, where do we get the information from, how do we trust the information. What is the recommendation for companies of that size and smaller with educating themselves in this space?
From a smaller standpoint, they are, I don't want to use the term vague, but you can Google information. You can Google things to educate yourself. If you're a small company, you know, it really comes down to taking the time, educating and telling your staff, you know, these are the 10 do's and don'ts when it comes to email. You know, you can get that. You don't have to hire necessarily someone big to come in. It's really just paying attention and being educated and knowing what you should and should not do. And the reality is, for a small, I would always just educate and tell them to always be alert when it comes to email. And that's one of the first things you can do. If it don't look good, if it don't pass the smell test, don't open it, don't click on the link, just kind of leave it alone. And that's really all you can do as a small business owner. Because if it's real, eventually think about, you know, in any type of business, if I'm sending you an email, if I'm not getting the response I need, eventually I'm going to call you, right? Hey, I sent you an email 3 days ago. Did you check it out? Oh, no, I thought, you know, I thought it was fake. Or it looks suspicious. I wasn't, you know, their email looked funny. You know, that happens. But that's the best thing you can do is always be more cautious when it comes to emails or clicking on links, anything of the sort.
Well, absolutely. I want to talk a little bit about our culture moving forward and how we're viewing some of these aspects, but we'll take a quick break on the station identification. Today's Trending Thursday is brought to you by Pro Elite Training. That's Pro Elite Training. Pro Elite is one word. You can find it in your app and Google store. Train your body through the muscle memory of a metronome to increase your rhythm, tempo, and pace. You can do that with NBA players, NFL players, and MMA fighters to enhance your ability to learn a skill set, make a team, or just get in shape. Pro Elite Training is the advanced way to do that. You can also find it at getproelite.com. This is Doctor's Orders. My guest today is Eku Williams of CyberSure, and we're talking about all things cybersecurity and user education and really how to protect yourself as a whole in this new technical world. If you want to join the conversation, you can do so at 859-291-2255. And if you want to send me a note personally, you can at info@drbaker.us. And so before we took that pause, Eku, I wanted to, you know, really look at what you've been seeing in the marketplace as it relates to our culture of just understanding that we need to be smarter about our relationship with technology and that we have to be active about it. We can't just kind of sit back and let things happen and then deal with them as they come, but more so be aggressive in our learning of it, seek the information, work with individuals that are experts in the space. Have you seen that that trend has been going up? Has it remained stagnant, or has it actually gone in reverse?
Oh, it's going up, but it's slowly but surely. You know, the reality is, depending on the size of the business or organization, you want to get educated, you want to learn about these things, but really, can you afford it, right? So that is the advantage of having a bigger organization. But, you know, I will also say there are a lot of free seminars out there to educate. For example, we would do events through the African American Chamber sometimes or other platforms or panels that are free. You know, if you are a small business, that's going to maybe take you a little bit of time, but do research on when those free events are occurring so you can get educated, so you can kind of get those updates on what to look for or what to do if you do not have like an IT team or something like that. But the reality is the more we are using technology, the more we are exposed to risk and vulnerabilities. And so it's very key that you should really do anything in your power or affordability to at least get that education and knowledge on what you're doing. Because what you don't want to do is open yourself up to risk. Because essentially what these cyber criminals are doing is not about stealing your information. It's really about locking it down and preventing you from doing your work. So if I could do that and stop you from what you do on a day-to-day basis, that's going to have a huge impact on you as a business, which can eventually take you out of business if that prevents you from day to day. Because there's a cost for that. Every day you cannot work, there is a cost for that. And that's the big thing that no matter size or organization, you have to think about is can you afford to be down? And what's that investment? Do I want to pay now or pay a whole bunch later if I'm potentially breached because I didn't want to take the time to educate my team?
Now, when we're looking at where we are, you know, as a climate, are landlines better where you have, you know, more on-site networks, or does the wireless and the cloud work just as good? Is there a pro for one over the other?
Well, if you think in landlines as far as, like, plug-in, I mean, it's good to have both, right? Bigger organizations will say are hardwired into the network, so you know you're connected by the cord. If electricity goes out, you know, there's going to be a router. You know, if you're on a Wi-Fi, boom, you're set down. People are using, like, those wireless, which I would consider VoIP phones, which is on the network. I tell clients, you might want to just use an old-school landline because of that. Because if electricity goes out, that means you can't even use your phone. But at least if you're on a regular landline, if there is an emergency, you can call out. So it's pluses and minuses to technology, you know, especially when it comes to the phone. You can do a lot more because it is connected to the network. But I always think about some things is, from an old school standpoint, it's better at least to have those as a backup.
Mm-hmm. And so that also means investing and understanding why you would invest in that. You made a statement earlier that, you know, cost is something. And are we to the point where the cost now outweigh, you know, whatever negatives that we think could exist? Because if we don't spend for it, and something happens, that can be significantly more than what we spent? Or is it still kind of at the phase where weighing out the cost still might benefit you in a way to where maybe I can piece this solution together and I can slowly get there? Is there a recommendation one way or the other?
I'll use an example of cyber insurance, right? So cyber insurance has skyrocketed over the last few years because of all the vulnerabilities, risk, and essentially insurances are paying out the wazoo. You have some companies that feel, based off the size of their organization, based off the amount of information that's on a network or stored or how they use it, they feel like it's actually cheaper for them not to get insurance. So what the term is self-insured, where companies will basically have a savings account for if they are breached, right? But some organization will say, in the long run, if I was to be breached, I don't know all what that entails. What does that really look like? So I might put $50,000 aside to in case I'm breached, but if you are breached and they lock you down, what if they ask for $70,000, right? Then you still, now you have to come out an additional 20 when you could have just had insurance and paid deductible of maybe 40. And part of that includes forensics, bringing up data, helping pay for loss of business. So you have to really think about what risk do I want to accept versus really spending, having that budget for insurance. Now, I use that example because that's the time that we're in now. That's what we're dealing with a lot at CyberSure, is clients are really trying to weigh their options. I always say, either you pay now or you're going to pay a lot later. And really, what do you think you can afford? Because eventually, if you're breached, the amazing thing is you'll somehow find the money in your budget. But you don't. But it's going to throw things off, or just budget for it, get the insurance. At least you know you're safe, right? So that's the way I kind of look at it from that standpoint. And as far as even when I educate and speak on panels to our other clients as well, is really what can you afford? Now, if you could just put $100,000 away and you're a business, sure, that might cover it. But again, that's on the individual organizations. But, you know, we all have different insurances that we buy, like American Home Shield. You know, those home warranties, you're like, I'm never going to use this. But that one time your washer breaks, now all I got to do is pay $70, and now I can get my washer fixed compared to, you know, spending a contractor spending $300-$400. So it just depends on the user.
And so they're wearing it out every day when they're making declarations on how to build their business and where should money be allocated in order to grow the business. Some people think that putting it into the foundation is the best use. Others are thinking about sales or marketing and generating more activity and then bailing it back later. I think that what you do for a living and how you do it, how much information you collect, I mean, clients you're talking with and the information that you're holding from them, I think all of that becomes important to your decision-making and how you go to look at, am I appropriately protected or can I piece this together for a solution, but at least my mind is on it. When you're talking to some of your clients, are you finding that they're seeking you out on their own because they came to the realization that they either need assistance or they need to upgrade their work, or are they being pushed there for some other reason and then they find out how important it is? What happens to CyberSure Tech typically amongst their base?
It's all the above. We have insurance clients that reach out to us. They want us to assess their clients and make sure they put them in a more accurate program. You have clients that call us because they want to get an assessment done, so they have no clue when it comes to insurance. You have clients now that realize we haven't had a policy reviewed in over 10 years. What is the best practice? What are we at risk at that we know technology has changed over the years? We have people who no longer work here anymore. We have new people to work here. What protocols, what controls do we need to put in place from that standpoint? Can you help me with that? Can you help us with doing an audit? You know, we have these positive procedures, but we don't know how well they work. Can you help us with that? So we do a number of things, and it really depends on the clients. We have insurance. We deal with MSPs that, same thing. We have no idea about cyber insurance. Can you help us out when it comes to that? Do an assessment so we can kind of see where the client is at. Can you appraise them? And what we do as well is we quantify the data that's potentially exposed on your network, because again, there's a dollar value to everything on your network or within your organization. What does that look like? How much, if you were to be down, how much does that really cost you? Those are things that we quantify, that when we work with our insurance partners, they want that done so they know they can give true and adequate policies for a client, because they don't want the pushback when they get breached. And a client says, hey, I thought I had insurance. Why am I only covered for this amount? Where it comes back, well, your policy was X, Y, and Z because of how you answered questions on your questionnaire. So we play that middle lane of making sure, hey, we're going to make sure you answered all these things adequately, but we're also going to verify that by doing an assessment on your network. We're going to take all that information as we have it assessed, we quantify it, then we'll work with and you can take that tangible information, provide it to a broker so they can get the adequate policies. And then, you know, at the end of the day, you may be paying more for a policy. Mm-hmm. You may be paying less. But at the end of the day, most people think, hey, if I go with you guys, my policy is going to be less. As we always say, we can't guarantee that. What we will guarantee is that you'll have a true, adequate policy. So that could be you were overinsured, now you need to be underinsured, or vice versa, but overall, you're going to have a true, adequate policy. And if that means you're paying more, it is what it is, but at the end of the day, you're adequately covered. You have a true policy, knowing that if anything were to happen, you're truly covered.
Mm-hmm. Now, with that coverage, has legislation changed much regarding cybersecurity or mandates, anything that you've seen come down the pike, whether it would be at the state level or the federal level, that small business owners need to pay attention to?
Not yet, but I believe it's coming. It's going to come to that in the near future, even how certain things need to be in place when it comes to cyber insurance. You know, I think at a certain point, you know, it's like car insurance. You know, you can get penalized if you don't have it and you have a car. Depending on the size, I believe depending on the size of the organization, you're going to have some sort of cyber liability insurance. And I don't mm-hmm. think there's going to be any way around that, especially like your third-party organizations that, you know, their whole premise is we store your data, we keep all your information safe and secure for you in our database, but then we're not doing everything to protect your information on our end. Are we secure? Can we...
Mm-hmm.
From that same standpoint. So eventually he's going to get there.
Makes sense. Do you think that's something that the people would embrace, considering that you know, this whole technology, cybersecurity at the level that we're playing in, it feels newer than what it is, but that's because things are changing so rapidly that solutions have to be made. But the entire population hasn't integrated with it or behaved with it in a way where it's all comfortable. So do you think that if legislation were to hop in and say, hey, we're going to put provisions out here to protect you all in these ways, is that embraced? Is that, you know, cause of fear and skepticism, or is it met with rejection?
I think it'll be accepted and embraced. I think depending on the organization, you know, it won't be skepticism. It might be some anger because now you're forcing us to spend more money than we want to, right? Because cyber insurance policies aren't cheap. So, I mean, we could argue about that when it comes to our car insurance. We know we have to have it. We don't like to pay for it, but it's something that legislatively has to be had or will be penalized. So it's going to be some sort of level of that, definitely. You can't get around it because of how bad these cybersecurity criminals are acting, how they're getting information, how they're locking it down, how they're impacting business. So it's definitely coming down the pipeline. It will be embraced because if I am an owner, I want to make sure my information is secure, or at least knowing that you're doing the right thing, have those in place.
Well, what's considered the right thing, you know, once again, is also very contextualized. There's an argument to be made that if you went out and you purchased too much protection or you bought too many tools, that's not advantageous for your company if you're not set up and have the appropriate framework to handle that. Whereas conversely, if you don't buy any or you ignore it, that is also not okay. Even if you felt like your dollars would have been better spent elsewhere, you still could have opened yourself up to risk, or maybe something happened and it caused a collapse or a crater or even just significant damage to your company. In that, you know, do you find yourself falling into philosophical debates regarding just the merit of how to scrutinize your data, your cybersecurity, your structures, your technology stack? Or do people just kind of hand that over to you without challenge? Because I guess in this instance, you would be the expert, you would have the experience, and all of this is so new. Which side of the coin does this fall?
They would call us with questions. It's not necessarily pushback because, as you stated, we are in that line of work. We're considered subject matter experts in what we do. So that trust is there. But now what I would consider is I state we are in a zero trust technical environment. And what I mean by that is now, depending on your systems, you can have insurance, you can have the best type of cybersecurity team in the world. There's still gaps somewhere, right? So people are coming in with that fear. Hey, if we trust you to do this, does that mean I won't get breached? And that's the thing. I can't guarantee that, right?
Because a lot of that comes on human error, right? You very well could be breached, but if someone didn't do something, didn't lock down, didn't close up, any of that, then that still leads to breaches.
Exactly. So that's when you hear like that pushback or those philosophical debates. It's really, do I really need this? What is the reason behind that? And can you assure me that this is not going to happen? And that's something we can't do because at the end of the day, as you just stated, it could be your coworker that clicks the wrong link. That means we did everything we were supposed to do on our end. We've actually provided you reports that shows you all your gaps that need to be mitigated or vulnerabilities that are on your system. We've shown you that. But again, you still have human error. Or even though you mitigate those vulnerabilities, people move and shake every day. Things happen every day in technology, and another vulnerability can occur. It's on you to put those right controls in place. But as we've seen Cisco, we've seen Amazon, we've seen technology giants get breached. Some human error, some they find the gap in the system and been exploited. So it can never be guaranteed, but what you can do is work as hard as you can every day to mitigate, at least find where those vulnerabilities are and begin to mitigate those.
Now, I know we talked about education is key, especially to the end user. Is this a scenario where this is more about fear, or is it more about wisdom?
It is, I don't think fear is a good word. I think there's caution, right? I think people aren't fearing the technology. There's a hope that it doesn't happen to them, but it's just really that level of being cautious now when it comes to technology and doing the right thing and being cautious. And I'll use the word educate once again, because that education gives you that wisdom of knowing what you should and should not do when it comes to your network or cyber resiliency.
Mm-hmm. And so with this topic, and as it continues to grow, what I'm hoping is that business owners are learning just from their own operation and their own practices, their daily behaviors, that maybe there's a better way to be safe and kind of be a part of your own rescue and save yourself some of the heartache and the pain that comes with, whether it's these breaches or, you know, identity theft. You know, I really want to look at that for a moment, because when I'm talking to business owners, there's a lot of them that have told me about how identity theft stopped their business from growing, or they've been hit with that. Does that typically happen based on bad technical behaviors, or is that because of some other factor that maybe we've mentioned, maybe we've not? But what have you seen that's led to the contribution of some of these identity thefts?
The same thing when it comes to getting breached in network, right? So, well, I think what we originally start off of, are you changing your passwords often? You know, are you using the same password at different sites? And is it simplistic, right? Are you using, you know, your fifth out, is your fifth, third username the same as your Amazon account? If that's found out, it's easily recognizable, because what these cyber criminals are doing is a lot of people's domains are sitting out on a dark web. So you have like this network of a private organization that's out on the web, that they are actually extracting emails and are getting information and selling them. So, for example, if you go to Amazon and you use my address is, you know, bearcats@aol.com. I'm just going to use that example. And your password is 1234. They use that domain. They sell that domain. They figure that out. And they use that same domain as a username to multiple sites across the board. They figure that out. They get that link information. They get your social security number, depending on the site. And now they're using that credit card information. Like, for example, if you store your banking information on a website, your web, your credit card information, if you're exposed, that's how they're getting it. So it's really to be cautious of, do I really want to even store that information? How secure is that website? And again, changing your password every so often, just to make sure you're trying to make it as difficult as you can for any cyber criminal, because they're that smart and savvy to get your information. So when people get their identity stolen, they're not just going and stealing your wallet. They're getting that information on the internet that you've exposed as a user and didn't even realize you were doing that.
Does this happen in bulk, or does this happen, you know, case by case? So let me qualify that some. And, you know, is it a scenario where, you know, you've been doing some online shopping at, you know, some major retailer, and they pulled out 100 different individuals that are now victims? Or is it based on individualized behavior and, oh, I see an opening here for, you know, Nancy Smith, so therefore we're going to take Nancy Smith's identity? How does that typically play out?
It plays out both ways, depending on the website, depending on how they extracted it. If an organization was exposed, they can just get that information. Or you have your one-offs, like Nancy. You just expose your information on a website where you shouldn't have, entered in the information or just not being educated, and clicked on that link and entered in your information where you shouldn't have. And that goes back to social engineering and phishing. You know, there's people who get their identity stolen just by answering a phone call. So they're still doing old school ways of getting information. It's not just clicking a link or reading an email. It's literally people answering a phone and giving away this information and then realizing my identity got stolen, and they don't even realize I gave John Smith, who called me last week, actually my all my information because I was working diligently. I wasn't even thinking about who I was actually giving my information to.
Mm-hmm. Which, you know, I don't know if this falls within the realm of your expertise. I know it's very irritating to me, so I just want to complain and whine a little bit since we only got a few minutes. But these spam phone calls, does that have a lot to do with that? Are they phishing with these spam phone calls, or is there some other technological measure that's going on that the common person is unaware of?
No, they're exactly what they are. It's the spam phone calls. Yes, they're phishing for information, but I say it's more on a social engineering because they are playing off of the human behavior of a phone call, having the right dialogue to have a conversation, whereas phishing is more on a technology side of social engineering, but it's just a different tactic. You know, everything is a tactic nowadays, and that phone call is just a different tactic to play off of human behavior to get your information.
And so with that, just, you know, being cautious of where information comes from, who you're speaking with, how you engage with that information, you know, with CyberSure, you know, in the time that we have left, number one, let's tell the listeners how they can contact you in the event that they want to have, you know, increased dialogue. And if they want even services out of CyberSure, how can they find you, Iku?
They can go to our website, www.cybersurellc.com. That is cybersurellc.com. I can be reached at 513-991-2220. That's 513-221-991-2220. Or you can email me at ewilliams@cybersurellc.com.
And so the work that you guys do is you're specializing, or better yet, before I tell them all of it, you tell them what your niche is, and if they needed to reach you, they're calling you specifically for what?
If you want to have your network appraised or get it quantified as far as exposed data and have an understanding of any vulnerabilities on your network, you can call us, and then we also help guide you to make sure you're adequately insured. So we work with brokers, we work with clients, we play that middleman as far as making sure that all your information is assessed adequately by putting a number to how much your organization is worth and how much you should be adequately covered for.
Well, I think the first part you mentioned is amazing, is the appraisal part, because there's so many companies that just don't know where they stand. They don't know where their risks are. They just never had the conversation. And so offering that is fantastic.
Right. And then we also do phishing exercises and educational seminars as well to help educate organizations on the basic do's and don'ts when it comes to cybersecurity and being cyber secure and being aware.
I think that's fantastic. When you talk about educating the end user, having those seminars is remarkable. And so if you're out there listening and you want to learn more, please contact Iku Williams and CyberSure so that you can be healthier as it relates to your technological needs and protect yourself against cybersecurity threats. Once again, I'm Dr. Baker. This has been Doctor's Orders on Trending Thursday. Thanks again to Iku Williams. Everyone, enjoy the rest of this day, and we'll see you tomorrow for Financial Friday. Have a great one.
Thank you for joining us for Doctor's Orders. You can contact Dr. Baker by phone at 1-855-249-4677, by email at info@drbaker.us. You can learn more on our website at www.drbaker.us. Be sure to tune in every Monday through Friday at 2 p.m. right here on 1320 AM, 103.9 FM, and on www.1320thevoice.com.